Today's program is brought to you by Domain. Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. For more information, visit domainstorage.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. And I'm just going to get right into it today because I'm so excited. We have such a special guest in the studio. We have Antonio Galloni. He's going to talk about Venice Media, their recent acquisition of Delectable and Banquet. And what I'm really most excited about in just a couple of weeks, La Festa di Barolo 2017. It is an event that I look forward to every single year. I get to participate as a sommelier. And for those of you who don't know Antonio, he is one of the world's most influential wine critics and educators, really. It's someone whose career I've been following since I worked at Italian Wine Merchants in 2005. And we would get his Piedmont report and all of us would huddle around it and highlight it and read it and discuss it. And it was just a great source of information for us back then when we needed, and we still do need, more informed voices talking about wine, writing about wine, educating us. He's someone who's been a big proponent of media with outstanding videos on his website, Venice. And I'm going to stop talking and just welcome Antonio. Thank you so much for coming to In the Drink today. Really excited.
Joe, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So your first foray into wine, at least I know, is the Piedmont Report. How did you get interested in Piedmont wines specifically?
Well, when I was a kid, my dad told me there were two great wines in the world, Barolo and Champagne. So that's really the long and short of it. My parents had a wine shop when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I grew up with it. I would look at these labels and I was fascinated by all of the words on a label and I wanted to understand what every word was. So that was the beginning of wine. My mom's father had a little bit, he had a corporate career. He had a little bit more refined taste. He liked a lot of French wines. Mm-hmm. And so there was always something on the table on Sunday. Maybe it was a Cote Rôti or a Burgundy, maybe not the greatest of wines, but certainly really nice wines. And that was just the beginning of falling in love with the things that are important to me about wine: history, tradition, place, and all of those things that you see on a label that you want to understand, where a wine is from, the vintage, who made it, the family, the grape, et cetera, et cetera.
And that stayed with you in your mind, because I think of you also as an ex-champagne expert. Obviously, your expertise spans all over the world in champagne, and Venice, I know, covers the entire world at this point of wine. But that's amazing that those words kind of stayed with you. I could just picture like your dad, like, son, we need to have a talk. Not the birds and the birds and bees. No. Champagne and Barolo. That's what's the best wine of the world.
Yeah, they weren't the greatest of champagnes or Barolos, but it was just the idea. You know, for my dad, Barolo was always, still is today. I mean, one of my favorite things is to drink a great bottle of wine with my dad now. But it was still this wine to be, it was the wine of kings, the wine to, you know, for a special occasion. And there was something special about those wines. And you know what a great Nebbiolo is like, that aromatic intensity, this sort of, sometimes you open a wine and the whole room can smell of perfume, and they're just such exotic and beautiful wines. And I was just very lucky that my parents introduced me to those wines at a really young age, taught me to value how special and artisan they were. And that was really the beginning of it. So I grew up with wine my whole life. I worked in restaurants before sommeliers were around. So I was a little older than a lot of people, but sort of dating myself. It was before, you know, it's one of my great regrets is that I never worked in a great restaurant as a sommelier, because I think that's got to be an amazing experience. But I was a waiter and I sold a lot of wine and I just was around wine all the time. And then I had a career in finance and it took me to Italy about 15 years ago, but it was before the euro. The dollar was very strong and I was taking people out to dinner all the time. And I started writing about wine just to keep track of my own wines that I had tasted. Then I would share those with friends, and they seemed to find interest in those wines, in those notes. And then when I went to business school, all of my friends told me I had to do what I loved, and that it was wine. So I just started writing about wine for fun, and that became a newsletter.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we got the Piedmont Horse. I know that you kind of glossed over a time in your life where you're a musician.
Yeah.
And you went to probably the best music school in America. And I read in your bio, you said that was actually really influential in informing your love of wine and your career later on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, music school was great. I learned a lot. I was not a very talented musician, so that forced me to be really resourceful. And so I started writing music because I learned that if I wrote, there were not a lot of people at Berkeley writing original music. And my roommate, it was my roommate who really inspired me to do this at the time. He said, if you write original works, you'll attract the best players. So I started studying composition and writing my own music. And that enabled me to play with musicians who were well above my own pay grade. And so that was a great experience. That was a really good experience in leadership, getting people together, building teams. But I think what I really learned about in music was I had a teacher who was an old cranky guy, and I took a class on the Bartok string quartets, which is very intense music. And this guy was really old and cranky and very un-PC. Probably half of the things he said today would get him, you know, fined at a normal school. But one of the things he taught me was he said, you should take one day a week and listen to music you don't like. And this was to me about really having broad horizons. And it, the reason it translates into music is because for me, quality is never stylistic. It's always, there's style of wine, but then quality is a layer of information that sits above that, mm-hmm. which means that to me anyway, there's great wines made in all styles and there's poor wines made in all styles. So I had a great 4 years at Berkeley. I played in Berkeley's country band. I played in a rock band that was more goth, like Cure, U2 influenced. Before that, I had played jazz 3 years in a big band in high school.
I would love to have seen you in a goth band. I think of you as a refined intellectual and... No, God, just going after it.
That was great. I mean, we had a rehearsal space in Boston in a warehouse space, not unlike this neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was in the Back Bay and maybe not the safest place to walk at 11 o'clock at night. And, you know, we played colleges and it was really fun. Mm-hmm. But it was basically the music experience was about participating in music in a lot of different realms. So I played in a lot of different types of ensembles in college, everything really from country to much more rock type music. And then when I moved to Italy, I studied opera singing as well. So for me, music has always been really important. And in fact, a lot of what I want Venice to be is very artistic expression of wine, because I think that most wine writing is pretty boring to read. And so I want our site to be very vibrant with maps, with photographs, with video, with things that are really engaging. And I think a lot of that is going back to the idea of music and the idea of being wanting to have something that's a creative outlet, not just information.
It makes a lot of sense. And in the early part of my career, when I was really focused on taking formal classes, I did a couple of years of the MW program and all of that. The thing that I most look back on those things most fondly about is the opening up to different styles. I would not have paid attention to wines from certain parts of the world that I'm glad I did. I'm glad I learned about those things. But do you find that you're allowed to have a preference of style for yourself, or at least publicly, can you talk about that? Or is it, since you cover everything?
Well, I don't cover everything. I mean, there's areas that are more near and dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. There's places that I wish I knew more about. I wish I could spend more time with German wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a beautiful 04 Côte Sancerre a couple days ago that I love, but I really don't know much about Loire wine. So we don't cover everything. I mean, maybe our publication does, but I'm certainly not well-versed on all styles of wine. There's plenty of things that I wish I knew more about that I can enjoy, let's say, as a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, wine is about sharing. And I think wine has a wonderful ability to bring people together, there's not too many things like it, let's just say. So I like to, when I am looking for a wine to open at my house, I always think, what will my guest enjoy? I don't think of myself. And therefore, I like, because I get to taste pretty much whatever anyway. So I like to have a diversified cellar that has everything from the most ripe, rich, hedonistic California wines to the most elegant Nebbiolos, champagne from grower to to Big House, because I'm not opening those wines for me. I'm opening those wines for somebody else, really. And I want people to have something that they enjoy. So,
you would have made a great sommelier.
Well, I don't know.
the big issue that you see so many times, a lot of times sommeliers choose their personal preference over what guests would like. And then you have so many guests who aren't articulate enough they're not able to say what they'd like. But it sounds like that is like exactly the right approach that someone should take as a sommelier.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so when I have... Because of the other stages of my life that are not in wine, I've got a lot of friends who are not in the wine business at all or involved in wine. And I would see when I would open for them maybe a Chablis or a grower champagne or something that's not necessarily an immediate wine, if I explained to them what the wine was all about, that the light bulb would go off. And so then I started to think, well, how do you make a million light bulbs go off? And that's about tuning into what turns people on. I think a lot of times wine critics are criticized, maybe in some cases it's correct, but they're trying to impose a taste on somebody else. And to me, that's not at all what we try to do. We try to help people figure out the wines that they're going to like. So therefore, maybe, you know, if we've got friends coming over and they've read about Sine Qua Non and they've never had a chance to open one of those wines, maybe that's what I'll open. Or maybe I know that they like older wines, so I'll open an older wine. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I know that they like Blanc de Blanc champagne. Or maybe I know that they would be curious to discover an up-and-coming grower that is where the prices aren't really expensive. So I always think about the person, and therefore, you know, I enjoy a lot of different styles of wine, not everything. I mean, you know, I'm not a huge fan of California Cabernets with perceptible sugar that are black and inky. So yeah, we can say that for sure. But I think that there's not that is also a bit of a old school style. I mean, it's an older style now that's kind of phasing out a little bit. So yeah, there's definitely things that I like and I don't like. But I mean, basically, I think wine is a product of a place. So I guess the wines I like the most are wines that have personality and that speak to something that is not reproducible.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Venice is you give so much context to it. Talking about California wines, too, you actually brought these beautiful maps made with just the top Italian cartographer. Is that what Masnageti is going to be? With Alessandro Masnageti, these beautiful maps of the Napa Valley. And for you, those of you guys who don't know, Masnageti is an Italian-based cartographer who really, I think he started with Barolo, right?
Yep.
Like mapping out all the vineyards of Barolo in just loving, exacting detail. I've spoken with winemakers who just admire him so much for his attention to detail. And what a cool project that you've brought this to the Napa Valley.
Yeah, so, you know, I
got,
you know, tired of getting lost, not knowing what was whose. And I thought, this is absurd. You know, Napa Valley is extremely diverse. I mean, most people think of Highway 29 and the Silverado Trail and the towns like Yountville and St. Helena and Napa that have a lot of restaurants and a lot of tasting rooms. But, you know, there's basically two mountain ranges, one on the east, one on the west. Then the foothills, which are basically the runoff of the soils from those mountains. And then the flat part in the middle. Napa Valley is much more diverse geologically and in terms of soils than most people realize. And I thought, you know, there's no maps for Napa Valley. I mean, there are no vineyard maps. There's a few isolated regions that have maps, but they're always done by chambers of commerce or groups that have a commercial or marketing angle. And so if you're not paying your dues to the association, your map might not be on the, your vineyard's not going to be
on
the map.
They'll just leave you out of it.
Yeah, and that sort of stuff, which is not our mission. Our mission is purely educational. So I thought, let's do really great Napa Valley maps. And, and we had done digital maps of Piedmont that were good, but they were like B or B plus work. They weren't our best. And I mean, they were very good, but they weren't, I wanted something of a higher level for this project. And so I thought, well, who do I want to work with on these maps? And Alessandro's the guy. So, we started chatting a couple years ago and now we've got six maps, some more coming in 2017.
Wow.
And these are the first maps that really show you exactly where the vineyards are by owner.
The detail's incredible.
Yeah, and so we've got Kelly White, who's written a phenomenal book on Napa Valley. She's part of our team as well. She does an enormous amount of the legwork and collecting information, fact-checking. And so it's just been tremendous. It's a real team effort, and it's just been a real joy to work on these.
And there's not just the map, but also your text that you write each one of them as.
Exactly. So there's a map on the front that shows you, like the Burgundy maps, like the Barolo maps, you know, who owns what where. And then the back is a history of each appellation. You know, the history of Rutherford, Thomas Rutherford, Inglenook, et cetera, et cetera. The history of Stag's Leap, Clos Duval, the Judgment of Paris, the Chase family, you know, and so on and so forth. Oakville has a very rich history as well. I mean, Howell Mountain, we did a map. That was an enormous amount of research there too. Mm-hmm. The land, going back to the land grants of the 1800s, the fact that Howell Mountain was originally chosen as for its timber to develop the valley. So there's a lot of history in these areas, and I think that the regions are worthy of first-class maps. And, you know, we've tried to do that. Hopefully we've been successful at it.
I think they're extraordinary. Where can our listeners find these?
Yeah, so Venice.com has all of the maps available. They're available in a sort of a poster size, which we ship rolled so that there's no creases. And then there's a folded version. And then we've got a few limited first editions that are signed by me and Alessandro as well. But most of the time, the folded or the frameable ones are the ones that people get.
Okay. And you have to be a member on Venice?
Absolutely not. Those are available to the public.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, another reason to check out the site. But it is worth being a member because the content is absolutely extraordinary. Okay. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more with Antonio Galloni. That's so exciting. On In the Drink, just after this.
Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. Since 2003, they've focused on making collecting easier and more enjoyable. With over 1.8 million bottles in storage across 5 facilities, Domain is the largest network of wine storage warehouses in the country. Warehouses are located in Chicago, St. Louis, Metro New York, Napa, and Washington, D.C., with refrigerated shipment hubs in dozens of cities. Their service also extends to the home collector. In the last decade, the team has organized and inventoried more than 1.7 million bottles in home sellers across the globe. Recently, Domain has launched a marketplace where clients can buy and sell wine. Trading in the network ensures that wines are stored at Domain facilities, and the commissions are the lowest in the industry. Go to domainstorage.com to complete an online questionnaire, and someone will get back to you within one business day.
All right, we are back on In the Drink with Antonio Galloni. The reason that I invited him here today, other than the fact that I've been dying to sit down and chat with Antonio, is really to talk about the La Festa di Barolo event that's coming up February 3rd and 4th here in New York City. I am honored to be a sommelier at this event once again, and he's brought in 15 of Barolo's greatest producers. I mean, I know every sommelier who is participating in this and the guests who have been years before are just ecstatic to see these guys once again. But can you tell us about how the La Festa di Barolo event started and what we can expect this year?
Well, Joe, we started doing events a few years back because I would go to events and as an attendee, and frankly, I was often not fully satisfied with the experience. And sometimes I'd get hired to do events for other people, and if something wasn't right, like the room was too full or the champagne that was served wasn't good, it would ultimately reflect on me. And so I just said to my wife, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, you know, we really ought to start doing these ourselves so that we can be, I mean, if we make a mistake, at least it'll be our mistake. And you know, we're not taking the heat for other people's choices. So Festa del Barolo started with the idea that there was really no place for people who love Italian wine to get together and open their great bottles of wine. And it really was a whim. I mean, my wife almost killed me or divorced me when we did the first one because it was organized in a really short time frame. I sort of said, gee, wouldn't it be fun to do this? And it turned into this event that was like, I think in 2011 or so. But the idea is about really about education. So the first thing about Festa del Barolo is that we do a tasting of a single vintage. But it's not a walk-around tasting. It's a seated masterclass tasting. And the reason we do that is that I feel that at walk-around tastings, there's the temptation. And let's face it, we're all wine lovers and consumers at the end. There's such a strong temptation to go to the rarest wine, mm-hmm. the hardest-to-find wine, the most expensive wine, and maybe not pay attention to the lesser, quote-unquote, producers. And you see this all the time. People just want to, and there's unfortunately, you know, sometimes people just want to say, I just tasted Latour or Ikem or Sassicaia or Monfortino. And I thought that that was a disservice to the other wines. And so when we do our tasting, it's a seated tasting on purpose because I want every wine to be presented on the same terms, which is every wine is served to you in its own glass at the right temperature, and then you decide whether you like it or not. But there's not this, oh, I've got to get to this table before they run out of wine kind of thing. Everybody gets to taste all the wines in ideal conditions. So since our mission is to be educational, I wanted that tasting to have a high educational value. So that's one of the events. That's on a Saturday afternoon this year. And then
And all of the producers, one of the things I love about it is you have all of the 15 producers there, and they all talk about their wine in the vintage. They're kind of on a panel.
That's right.
And you get to hear really a great amount of firsthand information from all of them, and you interject and ask really great questions. And so that's really special. I find with walk-around tastings, me as well, like... wine is very social for me, and so I end up like talking to people, and then I don't get to taste stuff I want to taste, or spend more time on some things and not enough times on other things. So this is a great way to really understand the entire vintage, and with Barolo, vintage is so important.
Yep.
So I love that event.
Yeah, so we do that, and so what that does, though, one of the things that does, you mentioned, we do have 15 producers on the panel, and that does limit the size of the event. So because I would love for Festa del Barolo to be 30 or 40 producers, or maybe to include Barbaresco or to include Nebbiolo from Alto Piemonte or other regions, but we frankly struggled with the way to do that and maintain the educational mission of the event, because I do want people to taste the wines on even terms, and I do want people to have a chance to listen to the producers talk. And we've had some amazing moments, like the first Festa del Barolo when Beppe Rinaldi came over. He got a passport just for that event. We didn't know until the last minute if he was going to come, you know. And when he spoke, you could hear a pin drop, because all of the psalms came out from the back. The room was really quiet, and that experience was really, I mean, I've visited him many times, as you have and other people have, but for people who've never heard him speak, it was like a life-changing moment. And, you know, I don't think it's really much of a that surprising that that's pretty much when these wines started to become unfindable in the market, was
it
after
really
that.
It really is. Yeah, I blame you. you can't
you're
see
mad?
I'm
mad too.
My fist at I get Antonio
less,
right
I
now.
Get less than I used to too, but so that's what we aim to transmit with the Festa del Barolo: moments, things that are irreplaceable. They have no value. The moment listening to this man speak was pretty amazing. Yeah. So that's the seed.
And this year, his daughters will be there.
This year, his daughters will be there. Yeah. And they've been coming now for a few years, and we've got other producers that are, well, we've got Roagna coming for the first time.
Luca Roagna.
And Alessandro Fantino hopefully will be able to come this time. Last time he had a bit of a health issue, so this will be the first time he's there.
Who worked at Bartolo Mascarello?
He made the wines there with Bartolo for a number of years, yeah. And now makes his own.
Conterno.
Roberto will be there. But, you know, I'm thinking about the lesser known.
Last year, my table was Barolotto, and he's like, I was starstruck.
Yeah.
So, I get starstruck for like actors. But,
yeah. So, Barolotto. So, the dinner that you're talking about, that's more of a concept bar from La Palais, which is an after the harvest celebration in France that's since been sort of mutated here in this country to more of a BYOB kind of dinner. And so, that's what this is. That's all of the producers at a table. But even here, Joe, what's really important to me is that people have a very intimate experience. So, the tables are always round. On purpose.
I like that.
Okay, so that way everybody can see each other.
Yeah.
They're not big banquet rectangular tables where you can only really talk to the people in your vicinity. So for me, the concepts of that dinner have to have round tables, unless it's, you know, well, it's always round tables, unless the space wouldn't allow it technically. But we want round tables where people can see each other. And we want the ratio of producers to guests to be 1 to 10, more or less, which is much lower than at a lot of other similar events like this. So you really are having a dinner. If you're seated at that Barolotto table, you're really having dinner with him. You're really having dinner with Luciano Sandrone. You're really having dinner with Silvio Altare. You're really having dinner with Roberto Conterno. You can ask them whatever you want. And people bring extraordinary wines. The last year was the most extraordinary of all because... You know, usually I can get a sense of the room before the event starts, and I can get a sense of which tables are going to be just absolutely dynamite and which tables, you know, maybe there's a little bit less wine or I'm not sure how it's going to work out. And last year I walked around at the end of the event and I saw the most amazing bottles on every single table.
Every table.
And it was just amazing. And so people will bring out all of their wines that they've been saving, all of the, you know, the rare wines. They're not necessarily expensive, because I think, unfortunately, there's this idea that wine price and rarity kind of have to go hand in hand. I saw a lot of wines that at the last Festa del Barolo that were rare, but not necessarily expensive when they were bought, like things like older Capilanos and things like that. So you see just incredible generosity, incredible sharing.
People sharing. It's the real nature of great wine.
And people bringing magnums and large formats. So that's more of a party. But the producers each bring two bottles of two wines that are not current releases. And so that's also fun because then you have
a chance out of their cellar,
so you get a chance to taste some pretty neat wines at the tables, and then the bottles get passed around inevitably, and it turns into a big celebration. But I think even there, you know, one of the things that's fun is that people have made lifelong friends from people that they've met. We see, because every time I'm in Piedmont in August and then in November, I see a lot of people from La Festa del Barolo who then go visit Piedmont. So what we're looking for, and what we try to do always at Venice, is we look for things where it's win-win for everybody. So, you know, we have 50 sommeliers from New York and around the United States who come here. They make great relationships with these producers. They get a chance to taste an amazing amount of wines. But the winemakers also get to show their wines to the sommeliers. And you know how it is. It's very hard to get in front of a lot of your colleagues.
Right.
So it's very beneficial for everybody. The attendees taste amazing wines. They get to meet the winemakers. Then they book their trips, their visits for the next years, and they get to know that. So it's an event where it's very synergistic.
I love it. I look forward to it every year. I get to hang out with my favorite sommeliers, the ones I look up to, the best ones, and get to meet the greatest producers of Barolo. The guests are all, they tend to be like really just cool, wonderful guests, and obviously the wine is outstanding. I tell a lot of our guests at the restaurants I've worked at and people I know are wine enthusiasts about it, because I obviously love to see them there. Something that I heard recently from someone who they're going to go to the 2012 panel, but they're not coming to dinner. He said, you know what? I don't have enough great large format. Like, I don't have great large format old Barolo in my cellar, so I'm just going to go to the panel. But like, what would you tell someone who wants to go, doesn't really feel like they have anything that's of the caliber that, you know, that they're is a little intimidated by what everyone else is bringing, maybe?
Well, we definitely do not want people to feel ever intimidated. You know, we've really worked hard to keep the price of this dinner. It's much lower than, it's not an inexpensive dinner, but it is much lower than all of the other similar things that happen that are like it. We don't want, you know, it's a tricky subject, because we don't want it to be unaffordable, either the dinner or make people feel like they've got to bring the most expensive collectible wine. You know, I don't really think it's about that. I think that Barolo is still a wine that is affordable next to the great wines of the world.
I agree, a relative value.
Exactly. And I would say find a lot of the merchants will go to a lot of the wine sellers in New York go to this event. And I would just, you know, if somebody wants to go, I'd say, you know, go to Chamber Street, go to Crush, right. You know, go to Zacky's, tell them you're coming to the Festa del Barolo and ask them to help you out, pick out a couple of wines that are going to be good, but they don't have to be Monfortino from the 60s,
right?
You know, but a lot of the retailers will come to this event, so they know what it's about. And, you know, I think, you know, find somebody that you like to work with that you can trust. It could be Italian wine merchants. It could be any of these folks who are really talented, Morels, et cetera, et cetera. And tell them what you want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going to Festa del Barolo. I need a good bottle or two. What should I get? This is my budget. And any regular retailer will set you up and you'll be fine. And, you know, they'll be happy to do it, because I think, a great camaraderie in the wine business.
I agree. They'd be excited to do that. Yeah, and you can find, especially at some of those places you mentioned, well-aged Nebbiolo, well-aged Barolo, maybe not from the top producer, top vintage, but it's a great value. Do you think, what do you think? I've heard a few people talk about Barolo. I know you agree that it's a great value compared to the other world's great wines. Do you think that the cost of it is going to increase drastically, the way I've heard some other people predict, in the coming years?
I think so, because people are, you know, if we had another half hour, I could tell you the whole deal, but basically global warming and climate change have been very favorable to Nebbiolo, because the grapes ripen much better than they used to. And that means you can open a 2008 Barolo today and actually drink it, whereas the wines that my dad liked when I was a kid were hard as nails. Mm-hmm. So people are buying the wines, they're tasting them, they're saying, wow, I like this, they're buying more. And it's creating an enormous amount of demand for these wines at the same time where other artisan wines like Burgundy and Rhone wines are skyrocketing in price, the availability for those best wines is very tight also. And so some of that is also inflating the prices for the top Piedmont wines.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah, and we should say Antonio went to business school at MIT, so he could probably write a dissertation on it. So thank you for keeping that as brief as possible. I did want to ask you about the acquisition of Delectable and Banquet. Delectable is something that I use all the time. I know all the sommeliers I know, my friends in the industry use it. It's great to, you know, not only share in the way that other social media apps are great with for sharing, but for me, just documenting what I've kept and reminding me of, you know, my own notes on wine. What led up to, like, why do you think that was a good acquisition? How did that lead up to that? Can you tell us about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I just, you know, I think that we've admired that app for a long time. In fact, when we built our own app, I gave the designer some screenshots from Delectable, mm-hmm. and I said, make it look something like this. Cool. It's very beautiful. It works very well. It's very elegant. And so we've always admired it. And when the opportunity came up to buy the company, it was or buy the assets, it was something that we couldn't pass up. There's great reach. I think people are very loyal to it. And that is something that we've also seen in the with the people who work there. There's just a tremendously positive vibe around mm-hmm. Delectable. And we just saw an opportunity to really reach an enormous number of people and to also improve it, because for people like you who use it a lot, I think that there's features that we can add to make it easier to, for example, sort 3-year-old notes and categorize your stuff. So we just saw an opportunity to do a lot of upgrades to it without changing the fundamental nature. So the biggest question I've got is, you know, are you going to make this an app that you have to pay for? Mm. And the very short answer is no. We're going to leave all the functionality exactly as it is. We want people to use it. We want people to use it a lot. But then we're going to add different bells and whistles to it in the coming months and hopefully make it even better and cool. more fun to use.
Anything you can tell us about, or they'll be surprised?
Well, you know, we've started to add little bits of Venice content onto Delectable. Oh, cool. Like, for example, things like, you know, some thoughts on finding value in California Cabernet Sauvignon, since that's a wine that people are drinking now around the holidays. For New Year's, we'll have a piece on Champagne. Top values in Chianti Classico will be on there. So there'll be just little snippets, you know, 5 or 10 of our favorite wines. We've got all of our wines under $25 now on that app. So we call those Venice favorites over on Venice. So we've ported that over. So now you can find, you know, a beautiful Suave, you know, because I fundamentally believe that wine does not have to be expensive to be delicious. So every week on Venice, we have a wine under $25. And so now those wines now appear on Delectable too. Mm-hmm. So it's about bringing everything together and making it a little bit more seamless. And, you know, I mean, who doesn't want an inexpensive wine that tastes delicious? We taste a lot of them and we want to share those with everybody.
All right. I think that's all the time we have today. Okay. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show, Antonio Galloni. I just want to remind everyone that I believe there still are tickets left for La Festa di Barolo 2017. You can find them on the Venice website. You should also subscribe to Venice. And if you love beautiful, informative maps, congratulations on these beautiful maps, the partnership you've done with Mesnaghetti. They're outstanding. Guys, Antonio Galloni, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for your time.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I want to thank Dave Tadashore and Aaron Fairbanks and the whole team from Heritage Radio Network. And thanks so much to our sponsor, Wines of Bordeaux. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.